Glad to see all of you this morning. I want to start in 1 John chapter 3 this morning, if we could, if you'd like to be turning over there. 1 John chapter 3, just a quick look at a verse in that book, and then one in Hebrews before we begin this morning. I'm trying in this series to bring some lessons that have to do with the realm of Satan and the kingdom of God, the realm of Satan and the kingdom of Christ. And I want to, my aim, as I mentioned last night when we were talking, my aim is really to try to wrap this up this evening with something that I hope will help us in understanding where's our battle, where's our fight, where's our, what does God have us here for? I mentioned this last night, and I'll just mention it again. I think I kind of grew up with the idea that, well, I needed to, of course, be baptized into Christ and become a member of the church and then just keep my nose clean and then go to heaven when I die. But I think it's important for us to realize that God has us here for a greater purpose than that. That's a wonderful thing to do. That's a good thing to do. But we're here for a greater purpose than that. He has in mind something far more glorious. And I feel like that maybe at least in my case, and if it's been with you, I hope these lessons will help, that we need to think about why He put us here. And we need to do two things. We need to hold our heads up a little bit and be able to represent these things that we're talking about to the people around us. Because most of them are struggling. Most of them can't see. Most of them have lost their way. Most of them have soaked up this realm of Satan that we talked about last night. And if we're not careful, it can even, it can encroach on us. And so we're here with a purpose to kind of help in the victory over Satan, if I could call it that way. And this morning, well, last night we talked about Satan, demons, and idolatry. This morning in the Bible class time, we talked about the kingdoms of the world and God's reign over the nations in Jesus Christ. And this today, I'd like to talk about Jesus and the victory over Satan. And tonight, we'll be talking about the armor of God. And one of the brothers last night mentioned our battle is not flesh and blood, but the principalities and powers. Tonight, we'll talk about that, the armor of God and the principalities and powers. So I hope you can be here and be a part of that. 1 John chapter 3, verse 8. Let me get this, see if I can get this slide up, make sure I'm where I need to be. Sorry, y'all, give me just a second. I had this working, but I think I did something. I believe it'll come up in a minute, but let's read 1 John chapter 3, verse 8. He that doeth sin is of the devil, for the devil sinned from the beginning. To this end was the Son of God manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. I know this passage is familiar to so many of us, most of you. But I want to think about it this morning. I want to use it this morning to kind of launch what we're going to talk about, Jesus and the victory over Satan. Jesus came, as John says, to destroy the works of the devil. In Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14, it reads this way, since then the children are sharers in flesh and blood, he also himself in like manner partook of the same, that through death he might bring to naught him that had the power of death, that is the devil, and might deliver all of them who through the fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. 2 points in those passages, that Jesus came to destroy the works of the devil, and then he came to deliver those subject to the bondage of the fear of death. To destroy the one that had the power of death. In 1 John, the works of the devil are sin in our lives. Jesus came to destroy that. In the Hebrew writer, Jesus came to destroy that power of death that holds us captive. So that's a beautiful thing to think about. And this morning, I want to talk about Jesus and the victory over Satan. Let's think about first, demonic confrontations. When Jesus was on the earth, we talked about demons and so forth last night. But this morning, I want to just think about what some things that were said when Jesus confronted the demons. Because of the way we read the Bible sometimes, we can sometimes filter out things that we don't think are applicable to us. We think they've already gone and passed away, and so we just kind of skip over that part subconsciously, I think. But if you read through Matthew, it's really amazing. All through Matthew, Jesus is confronting the demons. You know, they're coming out from everywhere. He's seeing them, the demons that are possessing people, but also the influence of teaching, the influence the demons had over the people that Jesus had to teach. And so we won't turn to all those, but if you get a chance to look through them, in Matthew 4, at the beginning of the chapter, you have the temptation of Jesus, and at the end of the chapter, you have one of these first confrontations. As soon as he starts, one of the first confrontations with demons, and then you have it in 8, 9, 12, 15, 17, I might have missed some. But Jesus is clashing with these demons all the time. As we said last night, they are afraid of him. They know who he is. He tells them to be quiet, and they be quiet. He tells them to come out, and they come out. He shows this mastery over the demons, but they're coming at him, or maybe trying to distract people from listening to him, trying to pull away from what Jesus is doing. In chapter 12, the Pharisees, when Jesus casts out a demon, and they don't know what else they can say, they say, well, he casts out demons by Beelzebub, the prince of demons. In other words, they're just trying to discredit what he's doing. They can't deny what he's doing, but they try to undercut it. And that's where Jesus has this to say about the unpardonable sin. We won't go into that this morning, but it has to do with their dishonest hearts, I think, and just seeing the evidence and just anything they can do to deflect it and reject it. But we won't go into that in detail. In Matthew chapter 9, when Jesus cast out a demon, the people said, we never saw it like this before. We never saw it like this in Israel. It makes me think, again, like I was saying last night, Jesus comes, and these demons are coming out of the woodwork, so to speak, and they're fighting against what he's doing. And part of Jesus' impact on the people around them is they're seeing this clash, seeing these demons cast out, and they said, we've never seen anything like this before. So it caused quite a stir. The implication of this charge that Beelzebub, that Jesus cast out demons by Beelzebub, the prince of demons, the implication of that Satan casts out Satan. Jesus said that doesn't make any sense. Satan can't cast out Satan. They're all working together. But again, he says, if I, by the Spirit of God, cast out demons, then is the kingdom to come upon you that we talked about this morning. I want to think about this phrase that he says in Matthew 12, and verse 29, where he talks about that let's turn and read it, because I'm going to misquote it if I try to do it from memory. Matthew chapter 12. Verse 29, I think. We won't read that whole context, but verse 29. Let's back up to 28. But if I by the Spirit of God cast out demons, then is the kingdom of God come upon you? Or how can one enter into the house of the strong man and spoil his goods, except he first bind the strong man, and then he'll spoil his house? let's think about that too for just a minute, what Jesus is trying to tell them. I think if I could paraphrase this, he's saying, I can't cast out the demon unless I first bound the prince of demons. I can't cast out the people in the strong man's house until I go in the house and bind the strong man. Jesus is telling them, this is a symbol of my power over the one who's the ruler of these demons. So just think about that idea. He believed that he had already won a victory over Satan. He had already won a victory over Satan. That's why he's talking this way. You see me casting out these demons? You know that I've bound the strong man. I've overcome him. So I want us to think about this morning, how did Jesus overcome the strong man? How did he overcome Satan already at this point? And then, of course, there's more to it. I'm not saying it's finished at this point, but Jesus is trying to tell these Pharisees, you need to open your eyes and see the power that's here in front of you. I came to destroy the kingdom of Satan as it's expressed in the kingdom of men. I came to destroy that, and I'm doing it. And you need to wake up and see what I'm doing. I mentioned this last night when his disciples go out and cast, and they come back and they're amazed because they can cast out demons. Jesus said, I beheld Satan falling like in heaven. I think he's referring to not the future, but he's referring to what's already been done. He's already referring to what was going on right then. That he had started on his mission. He was already working on it. Well, let's think about how he might have been doing that. I'd like to think about the temptation in the wilderness, first of all, for a few minutes about this. At least from, and it could be that there's more before this that, you know, the Bible doesn't tell us about, but when Jesus begins his mission, the first thing that happens to him, he's led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Matthew tells this, Luke tells this. First thing, right off the bat, before he goes to his ministry, he goes and he faces the devil in the wilderness. This is a really interesting story, I think, for us to think about. Try to picture Jesus. You remember when the temptation occurs? It's after he's been fasting in the wilderness for 40 days. So you can imagine he's famished from a human standpoint. He's in a, I don't know if vulnerable is the right word, but certainly could be easily tempted by the first thing that Satan comes to him, turning the stone into bread. But without belaboring each step of the temptation, I want you to think about this, that he's really not tempting Jesus with evil, per se. He's not tempting Jesus to rob a bank or take drugs or, you know, he's tempting Jesus to just take a shortcut. Just take the easy way. You know, you're hungry, just use your powers to turn those stones into bread and enjoy yourself. Jesus said, no, man shall not live by bread alone. Then, of course, he takes him shows him the kingdom of the earth. If you'll bow down, worship me, you can have all this. And it doesn't detail this in the temptation accounts, but I can't help but think that Jesus in his mind was saying, yes, I'm going to have them, but I'm going to have them in the way God wills for me to have them, not from your hand. Remember, Satan owned these kingdoms in a sense. He was the ruler of the kingdoms of the world, in a sense. And he says, if you just worship me, I'll turn it over to you. So again, it's not so much a temptation of evil as it is here's a shortcut. You don't have to go to the cross to purchase the kingdoms of men. You can take a shortcut. Jesus said, no, I worship God alone. Go back to the idolatry we talked about that last night. Worship God alone. Rely on God alone. And then that third temptation where he was taking the pinnacle of the temple, he says, cast yourself down. wanting Jesus to maybe take some glory, make a display, you know, make something sensational rather than just simply trusting God. Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. I think maybe what that means is don't try to just see what you can get away with. Don't see what God will let you get away with. Submit to Him. You know, honor His will. Work for His will. At any rate, I spent too much time on that. What I want to mention here is that Jesus, He is tempted not just by Satan, but by the ideas all around Him that come from Satan and from these demons, you know, it would be really great to overthrow Rome. All of the people around Jesus, they said, we've got to get these Romans off our back. If we can find a way to do it, I'm sure Jesus was tempted with these things. That is, it was put in front of Him to identify with His people and do what. But Jesus is always holding Himself to do the will of the Father. When he gets through that temptation, and then He goes out to preach and teach, He has power now over the demons. I'm not saying I know that He never had it, that He didn't have it before that, but what I'm saying is that in Jesus' view, the victory over Satan, it wasn't just His cross, it included that, but there was a road going to that, and that road, He needed to do the will of God. He came to do and say, He said many times, I only say, do what my Father tells me. I only do what His will is. That's what I'm trying to do. So, just a quick lesson for us before we move on. Would you think about this idea that Jesus saw His battle as kind of a cosmic battle. It wasn't a political battle. It wasn't a military battle. It wasn't a earthly wealth battle. It wasn't economics. It wasn't education. He had this battle of spiritual forces that were coming from Satan and represented by these demons, represented by the teaching that was going around, represented by the power of Rome, by other pagan powers, represented by the corrupt Jewish leadership. Jesus had all of these things that He had to battle against. But He kept the battle on the right plane. He kept the battle in submission of His will to the will of heaven. He remembered why He came. And I leave that point by saying this. For us, the decisive battle is in the mind and in the heart, right? It's not when you get to the beer joint and get on the bar stool. That's not where the battle is fought. You know, it's before that. It's not when you're knee-deep in debt and you're trying to scrounge around and find a shady way to get out of it. It starts a lot earlier than that, this battle of the will, this battle of the mind, battle of the heart, that I've got to be submitted to the will of God. This goes back to the idolatry we were talking about last night. The thing that we rely on is the thing that we worship. It's the thing we rely on money, we rely on drugs, we rely on sex, we rely on power, we rely on popularity, we rely on glamour, on beauty. If that's what we rely on for our purpose and our satisfaction, that's our God, that's our idol, that's our worship. That's coming from the realm of Satan. So Jesus, I think, is saying to them, I've bound the strong man, I've already faced him. I'm not saying it was over yet, because Satan still comes after him. But he says, I've already faced him, and I've put him where he needs to be. And what you're seeing around me and casting out these demons, it's the evidence of that. Let's look at Matthew 12, right after this story about the casting out of demons, and this is by Beelzebub, in Matthew 12, in verse 43. Let's turn and read that if we could. Right after that demon was cast out, the Pharisees asked him in verse 39, we won't see a sign. They kind of lost that battle with him. So they won't put him, trip him up some other way. We won't see a sign. Jesus, of course, tells them that no sign will be given. Talks about they will be condemned in judgment by the men of Nineveh, the queen of the south. But look at verse 43. But the unclean spirit, when he has gone out of a man, passes through waterless places seeking rest and findeth it not. And then he says, I'll return to my house because I came out. And when he's come, he finds it empty, swept, and garnished. And then goeth he and taketh with himself seven other spirits more evil than himself, and they enter in and dwell there. And the last state of that man is become worse than the first. Notice this last phrase. Even so shall it be unto this generation. I'm always puzzled about that illustration, and there's certainly several lessons you can get from it. But once you turn around and read it in this context, I think Jesus is applying this parable to the Jewish leadership. And he's saying, you know what you did? You think you cleaned house? And what you did is you brought in seven worse demons. You think that you bucked against the Romans and tried to clean out the temple. You know, there were these rulers during the time before Jesus that really profaned the temple. And there were these Jewish zealots that tried to come in and do something about that. The party of the zealots was known in Jesus' day, the party of the Pharisees. They said, we're going to clean this up. And they had all these ways that they approached kind of cleaning out the evil spirits out of the house of Israel. But what they did, I think what Jesus is saying here, you opened it up to a lot worse situation than you were to start with. You opened it up to allow these seven, and I think it's a parable, it's obviously just a parable, but it's to try to teach them a lesson that you're worse off than you started out. They're not interested in honesty and truth. You can see this in chapter 12. All they're interested in is holding on to power and kicking, you know, discrediting him. And Jesus is saying, you know, you think you're doing the will of God, but you're worse off than when you started cleaning your spiritual house in the first place. Maybe they had the idea, and in fact, I think this did happen in history. They said, we like Herod, even though he's a crook and a, you know, a murderer. I mean, the worst kind of person. But he'll help us with the Romans, so he can be our king. You know, so they're like taking ungodly routes to try to get to where they need to be spiritually. They think, and Jesus is telling them, off when you started. They didn't really get to the problem. Jesus said, I'm coming, I can cast them out. I can handle this problem for you. But you have to submit to the will of God. You have to allow God to dwell with you. And as long as you don't allow God to dwell with you, you're still going to be in worse shape. Than when you started trying to fix all of it. I think the lesson that I want us to think about from this is that Jesus is viewing this battle as it's a battle against Satan, and it's a battle against the demons, it's a battle against these powers. But how is that manifested? It's manifested in Rome, and in the corrupt high priest, and in the Pharisaical system, in the corrupt Jewish system. It's manifested in a lot of different ways when Jesus comes to the earth. And so, he's trying to hold true to being the representative of his people, the servant of Israel. He's trying to hold true to that calling, and yet, most of them are corrupt. And he's trying to hold true to the idea about the defeat of pagan powers, but not by military conflict. So Jesus is trying to walk this line about this spiritual battle and trying to get to their hearts when he's got all around him pressures from different, you know, that are coming from different, a different mindset. So let's think about the cross, and we'll stop this morning. The judgment and the casting down of Satan. Jesus said in John chapter 12, now is the judgment of this world. In John, if you've studied through John recently, you might have noticed there are several times as you come through the Gospel of John that Jesus said, my hour is not yet come. The time is not yet. People will say it, his brothers tell him, you need to go down to Jerusalem. No, my hour is not yet come. He kept delaying teaching them that something was coming, but it wasn't time yet. Well, in John chapter 12, when you're coming right to the last week of his life, in John chapter 12, he says, now the hour is come. The hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. He says, now is the judgment of this world. Now is the ruler of this world cast out. John 12, verse 31. A little bit later, in John 14, he says, the prince of this world is coming. He has nothing to bring. Talking to his disciples when they're out, they're going out to get ready to go out to Gethsemane. He said, the prince of the world is coming. He has nothing to meet. Now is the judgment of this world. Now is the ruler of this world cast out. And very interesting, when he tells his apostles in that same setting in John 16 about the Comforter coming, about the Spirit coming, and he says when he comes, he'll convict the world of sin and righteousness and judgment. Of sin because they believe not in me, of righteousness because I go to the Father, of judgment because the ruler of this world is judged. That's a hard passage, and we don't have time to talk about it, but I just want to make this point. He's saying the Spirit will teach about sin, about righteousness, and about judgment to know the difference between them, to know what's going to happen to people that are on the side of sin, on the side of unrighteousness. Because the judgment is coming because the ruler of this world is judged. It's like, you're going to need to tell people, get on the right side, or you're going to be on the wrong side. Get on the right side, or you're going to be judged with the ruler of this world. I don't know how many of y'all saw this movie several years ago, The Passion of Christ. I think they showed it all around the country, and a lot of hoopla about it. But there's one scene in that movie where Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane, and it shows him stepping, I believe, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but it shows him stepping on this serpent. So he shows his sandal coming down on the head of the serpent in the garden. And a lot of people got up in arms and they said, that's not in the Bible. And it's not. I mean, that particular story is not. But I think the thing that I wanted to think about is as Jesus is getting ready to go to the cross, he has this time of agony in Gethsemane, and he tells his disciples as he's meeting with his disciples right before this, he says, Judas is going to betray me. And then the apostles say Satan entered into him and Judas does the betrayal. And so I don't know whether this could be maybe behind that idea, because Satan comes to the garden in the form of Judas, or through Judas, Satan comes to the garden to betray Jesus. So maybe he has a role in that from that standpoint. But I thought it's also interesting. Thought it was also interesting that he tells Peter and James and John, watch that you don't enter into temptation. He tells them that there's something going on here, and you need to be aware of it. You be careful that you don't enter into the temptation. And it makes me think that he's saying, I'm going to be tempted. I'm going to be tempted in what's about to happen here. And of course, you know what he said, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me, and nevertheless, my will. So when Judas comes with the high priest's men to get him in the garden, he says, this is your hour and the power of darkness. In other words, this is the battle. This is bringing it all to a head. He speaks there about
feet of Satan in the cross.
So Satan is working with Judas, with Judas to, not only Judas, but it does specifically mention about Judas, to put Jesus on the cross. Satan is doing something else at this time. Peter's saying, no, you can't go to the cross. You can't do it, you know. And Jesus said, get behind me, Satan. So you got Satan trying to push Jesus to the cross, and you got Satan trying to push the apostles to not accept what he's got to do. You know, again, this idea we talked about last night, Satan is doing the will of God. He's doing what God, he's not meaning to, but he's carrying out what the will of God intends in the crucifixion of Jesus and the deliverance of all of them. And Peter, when he says, no, Jesus, you can't do it, Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. So let me just wrap up quickly here this morning with these points. Think about the cross. Think about the cross of Christ in this way. He bore the sins of all. He bore the sins of the Roman powers that are putting him on the cross. What I mean by that is he submitted to that load, to that sentence, to that what they inflicted on him. He bore their sins in that way. The Jewish religious corrupt leaders, he bears their sins. He submits to what they put on him. In order to crush the power of Satan, Paul says in Colossians 1, he translated us in the cross. He translated us from the power of darkness into the kingdom of his dear Son. In chapter 2, he said he disarmed in the cross the principalities and powers. He disarmed them. He made a public spectacle of them triumphing over them in this. But it wasn't what they thought it would be. It wasn't the way they thought it would be. It wasn't the way the Jewish leaders expected. He's defeating Rome. He's defeating the Jewish leaders. He's defeating Satan. He's defeating the powers of Satan. Remember the lamb from what we talked about this morning? With apparent weakness, with apparent, was submitting to a sacrifice. The power of sacrificial love. He who saves his life shall lose it. He who loses his life for my sake shall save it. If any man will come after me, let him take up his cross and deny himself and follow me. You see in Jesus' cross, it's not just a token that we pay some homage to, that Jesus did something for us and we're off the hook. He did do something for us to deliver us, but he asked us to enter into it, to enter into this battle in the defeat of Satan. How do we defeat him? By the power of self-offering love, submitting to the will of God. This is the most, we said in the earlier hour, this is the most powerful thing in the universe. It doesn't seem like it to the world, and sometimes it doesn't seem like it to us, but it's the most powerful thing in the universe. Colossians 3, we as new creatures are renewed in knowledge after the image of him who created us. Think about back to our first lesson. We put on the earth, bear the image of God. Now we're recreated in Christ. We're recreated to bear that image anew according to the one that created us. How do we do that? By submitting to that sacrificing love to accomplish the will of God. He puts us here for a purpose. If we fail to see that we're the representatives of God in the earth in Christ, if we fail to see that, we fail in our mission. Tonight we're going to talk about the armor of God and the battle against the principalities and powers. Try to think a little bit more about what does it mean for the way we ought to way we ought to live, the way we ought to teach. And I'm not talking about preaching. I'm talking about how our lives ought to teach, ought to influence those around us. The cross was the defeat of idolatry. It was Jesus summing up while we're here on this earth. We're here to live for the will of God. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's why we're here. That's what Jesus came for. That's what his cross calls us to. And it declared the power of holy and humble and sacrificial self-giving love. Thank you for your patience and listening this morning. I hope it helps you to think about what Jesus did in the cross, what he did in his life and his battle against Satan, what he did in the cross in delivering us from the power of darkness and into the kingdom of his dear Son. If you are here this morning, you're not a Christian, we didn't go into this about what you need to do, but let us know if you'd like to talk about this. This idea that we submit ourselves to the will of God, that we come to Christ in penitence and trust in him, turn our lives over to him, that we confess him as Lord, and that we're baptized into his death. We unite with him in that and raised to this new life to be new creatures that bear the image of God. If you're subject and you're interested and you're open to even explore this, we invite you to come.